Okay, so. save your time. I just want to say like this. This class, I'm so glad you're here because.
I stand here.
It was so important for me to have Rachel come and speak to you guys because, unlike every class that you have at Pardes, of course, can change your life, this one can save your life. And this is meant to be a class that's designed for you to put into practice. I begged Karen, please, please make time in the year, because it's impossible that we could have a room full of people who are thinking about, who are at this stage in the life of thinking about making permanent relationships and not think seriously about how to have a Jewish marriage that also protects both members of the union. Rachel Levmore is the person to give this talk. She's the person who has a long career as a rabbinical court advocate, as a Tohenet Beit Din, and literally wrote the book, which is called Mini Einech Midima, about the prenuptial agreements, about which you're going to hear right now. Rachel is really the source who has been the forerunner in creating and actualizing prenuptial agreements in this country. And so I really don't want to take up too much. Just thank you so much for coming in. And
the proper response is, it's my pleasure. But it really, really, really is my pleasure to come and share with you knowledge that I have with a room full of your generation. Because what I'm going to tell you, I think, speaks to your generation. It certainly speaks to your generation much more than it speaks to my generation. And you'll get it. I think that you'll get it. And you should use it. All right, so let's begin. We're talking about Jewish marriage. When you enter a Jewish marriage, it's obvious to you that someone who is coerced cannot enter into a marriage. In other words, you enter a marriage by agreement of both the bride and the groom. That's how the marriage is consecrated, by both of them agreeing. In Judaism today, to exit a marriage, to end the union, to dissolve that union, it also has to be done by the agreement of both spouses. Not like what you're used to. And we don't have a lot of time, so I'm doing away with a legal explanation. I'm going straight into demonstrating what the problem is. And everything that I tell you, what I'm advising you to do, is from within deep halachic conviction. In other words, it's in accordance with the halakha, it's in accordance with Jewish tradition, and it's to solidify Jewish family units so that we can have a healthy Jewish society. Is there anyone here who has not heard of the term aguna or naguna? I will explain. There are actually two definitions of the word aguna, and when you're speaking to somebody about it, you have to clarify which definition you're referring to. The classic definition of an aguna is a woman whose husband has disappeared. For example, he was on a boat, and the boat sank in waters that have no end. That comes from the Talmud. So we don't know if he grabbed onto a plank and he floated to a deserted island, and he's still alive, in which case his wife is still married to him, and we would do everything, call out all the helicopters, and try to find him and rescue him from the deserted island and bring him back to his home and his family. And his wife is a married woman, an eshet ish, right? She's a married woman. Or we don't know if he sank together with the ship. And since the waters have no end, meaning it's in an enormous ocean, we cannot check the rim of a lake to see if he came out. So he died, but we don't have any proof that he died. We don't have proof that he died. So what is the personal status of his wife? is she a widow or is she a married woman? If she's a widow, then she is then remarriageable. She can remarry and build her life again. However, if she's not, we can't prove that he's dead, then the classic definition of an aguna is a woman whose husband has disappeared, and we don't know if he's dead, or we cannot get from him notification that he wants to divorce his wife. We can't change her personal status. She's a chained woman, she cannot remarry, and I call her, in English it goes very well, a husbandless wife. She's got the status of a wife, but she has no husband. That's the classic definition of an aguna. There, today, in our age, there are still classic agunot. An example is, terribly, the women whose husbands perished in the World Trade Center in 9/11. And not only Jewish law, but the state of New York had to pay out insurance policies. And they didn't want to pay out an insurance policy until it was proven to them that the person actually died. Because it's quite possible that a guy didn't reach work that way, saw the World Trade Center fall, and said, oh, I can now abandon my wife and children, and I can leave town, and it would be an insurance scam. So any legal system needs proof. So the women and they're all young women, whose husbands were in the World Trade Center and were killed there, it took a year to release them from their stage of their status of matrimony as being married. So there are still cases of real aguna. However, in the past 100 years or so, it's getting worse. There is a situation called the modern day aguna. That term was coined in 1989 by the rabbanim, the rabbis of Yeshiva University. The modern day aguna, in other words, a victim of get refusal, is a woman who wants a divorce from her husband, and he's refusing to give her a get. A get, the Jewish writ of divorce, the piece of paper that he has to hand to her and give to her. He's refusing. What does that mean, he's refusing? So now I'm going to explain what the difference is between the laws that we're familiar with from whatever country we came from, whether it's the United States or Europe, and Jewish law. Let's take the United States as an example. There are 50 states in the United States. When you open divorce proceedings there, if it's not divorce by agreement, if it's not amicable divorce, and I'm not talking about amicable divorce at all in these words, if one side sues for divorce, so one spouse wants a divorce, one spouse doesn't want a divorce, what happens? You go to court, you go to family court, and there's a judge there. There are two major differences between going to a civil family court in a democratic state and suing for divorce and going to a rabbinic court, whether it's in Israel or it's abroad, and demanding a Jewish divorce. Now, someone who is married under an Orthodox ceremony, and all Jews in Israel marrying under the auspices of the state are marrying under an Orthodox ceremony, or Jews abroad who marry in an Orthodox ceremony, if they want to be remarriageable, if they want to exit that union and be able to remarry in accordance with Orthodox halacha, they have to have a get, the man and the woman. So, if you go to a civil court and you open a file, you know, depending on the state, that they have to go through a certain procedure. A certain amount of time has to pass. In Nevada, it might be a few weeks. In New York State, it might be 2 years. But you know that at the end of that period of time, the judge will take his gavel or her gavel, bang it down and say, I hereby now decree that you are divorced. What did I just say? I just said that someone outside the union, it's the judge as a representative of the state, he's not married, he's not one of the spouses in the union before him, he's an outsider. He has the power to change their marital status from married to remarriageable, to divorced. It's an outsider. Even if one of the spouses, doesn't matter which one, is standing there and yelling, no, no way, you can't do that. We are married. I don't care what you say. It's not true. The judge has just changed their marital status from married to divorced, and they're both free to remarry. An outsider has that power. Let us compare that for a minute to a rabbinical court. Again, whether it's abroad or whether it's here. If you go to a rabbinical court and you sue a divorce, if both spouses indeed do come in order to have a kosher, a legally, halachically, Jewish, legally valid, according to Jewish law, a kosher divorce, the man has to give the writ of divorce, literally, place it in the hands of the woman, and the woman has to accept the divorce. Meaning that the two spouses, and only the two spouses, have the capability to change their marital status from married to divorce, free to remarry somebody else. The judge, the rabbinical court judge, no matter how much he wants to see that couple divorced and thinks that there's been all sorts of terrible things going on in that marriage, and he said, you must separate from each other for your own sake, for your children's sake. You must lead separate lives, and then you'll have healthier lives. I order you to give a get. I order you. I'm compelling you. I'm coercing you. I'm obligating you. Give a get. If the man doesn't give the get out of his own free will, there's no divorce. The judge cannot change the personal status of the spouses. It has to be the two spouses. Let's move on to the next major difference. Let's talk about no-fault divorce. I think in all the democratic countries by now, New York State was very late, there is now no-fault divorce. What does that mean? And it wasn't, by the way, that wasn't the case when I got married. I mean, I'm not that old, but nevertheless, when I got married, and I didn't know about this, right? If I would have, I didn't, thank God, but if I had, I got married in New York State, lived in New York State, if I had wanted to get a divorce in New York State, there were still states in the United States, including New York State, that had divorce by fault, meaning you had to prove fault in your spouse in order for that judge to decree, issue a divorce decree against your spouse's will. And there was a different states had a different list of what grounds were that were the accepted faults. For example, that abandonment, unfaithfulness, right? Cheated on you. Was sent to a term of incarceration for 3 years. Meaning, if he committed a crime and he was only jailed for a year and a half, that wasn't grounds for divorce. I'm talking about the United States. Right? I'm not talking about halacha now, about Jewish law. So there was a distinct list of grounds for divorce. By now, all democratic states, as far as I know, and all 50 states in the United States, there are no-fault divorces. Meaning, you come to the court, you open your file, and you don't have to wash a dirty laundry. You don't have to say he's a drug addict. You don't have to say there was physical violence. You don't have to say anything. You can say, I want a divorce, irreconcilable differences. And then, like I said, there'll be a procedure. It takes a certain amount of time. But at the end of the day, whatever that period of time is, the judge will change your personal status. So in civil court, there's no need to prove grounds for divorce. Fault. No need for fault. In Jewish law, in order for a rabbinical court to agree that, yes, we have to take care of this matter, this case, and we will administer the divorce, we'll oversee it, you need a rabbi to write out the get, and you need a rabbi to oversee the ceremony, just like you need a rabbi to take care of what goes on under the chuppah when you enter the marriage. So this is the undoing. So you need the dayanim, you need the rabbinical court judges to do that. So, but in order for them to accept the fact that, yes, there has to be a divorce here, and to rule there should be a divorce here, you have to prove fault. And proving fault is not easy, because it's topsy-turvy upside down. What did I say earlier? I said that a get is kosher only if the man gives it out of his free will. So you have to convince the rabbinical court that they should obligate him or even coerce him into giving a get. But then, is it out of his free will? Well, there's a problem there. Now, Jewish law deals with that, but you can see that it's problematic. But what happens is that you have to prove fault. And proving fault, there are certain rabbinical courts that will say, you say that he's an alcoholic, right? Nobody's ever seen him take a drink. He's bringing me two kosher male witnesses that are not related to him that makes them kosher. If it's a witness that's his brother, he's not a kosher witness. Two kosher, unrelated male witnesses that saw him in a state of drunkenness. Go find two kosher male witnesses that saw him drunk. Go find two kosher male witnesses that saw him physically abuse her in the bedroom. Doesn't exist. Today it doesn't exist. And we don't live in a little town in Europe anymore where everybody knows everybody else's business and what's going on in the bedrooms, right? We just don't. So getting the rabbinical court to agree that, yes, there has to be a get here, is difficult because of the necessity to prove grounds. It's more difficult in Israel than it is in abroad. Because abroad, you have a situation that you have civil divorce in whatever country you came from. And there is a ruling in Jewish law that most rabbinical courts abide by, that if there is a civil divorce, then the man is obligated to give a get. In other words, you don't have to go through the process of proving grounds. That's enough. They're living apart. He has to give a get so that they can both begin their lives anew. Here in Israel, it's much more difficult. There is no such thing as civil divorce. Here in Israel, the get is the Jewish and the civil divorce, and you have to prove grounds. And then you have a catch-22 situation. How's that? A woman asked her husband for a get. The husband said, "Ma pitom?" That much Hebrew, you know? Yeah, okay. And he says, no get. No way, ma pitom, I love you. And she is suffering, and she's got cause. Whatever it is, he could be, as I said, an alcoholic, he could be beating the kids, he could be beating her, whatever it is. He could be hooked on something, whatever it is. She sues him in the rabbinical court. We go into the rabbinical court. There's a dais. The three venerable, they look venerable, they really do, venerable judges sitting behind the dais, the raised desk, right, with hats and full beards and long black coats. And they say to her very nicely, Gveret, what would you like us to do? Why did you come here today? And she says, I want a get. And they said, okay, tell us why you want a get. And she has to utter the words, she has to make a claim, let alone prove the claim, that he's an alcoholic, he's a drug addict, that he abuses her, he abuses the kids, whatever it is, she says it. She has to say it. Why? Because she's got to convince the Beit Din, the rabbinic court, that yes, there's room here for a get. We will rule that there should be a get here. What happens as soon as she says he's an alcoholic? What does the guy say? She's lying. What? She's making up stories. She's lying. What's his reaction? She let his dirty little secret be known in public, and no less in front of three venerable rabbis. So he is furious. When they leave that room, he says to her, now you'll never see a get. Because he's being vindictive, because she told his dirty little secret. Right? So the woman is in a catch-22 situation. She has to tell the rabbinical court what the problems are in the marriage, or else they won't rule for the arranging of a get, and they won't arrange a get. And he, on the other hand, doesn't want anybody to know his secret. And if she tells his secret, he gets even angrier and even more recalcitrant. So we are in a bad situation. Almost everything of what I'm saying is a two-way street. In other words, if the problem of get refusal exists, it exists both for men and for women. However, it is more serious when a woman is the victim of get refusal than a man. Why? Because according to the Torah, a woman can't have two husbands, and the law, civil law, but a man can have two wives. According to rabbinic law, a man can't have two wives. It's Rabbeinu Gershon. Charon de Rabbeinu Gershon, he forbade polygamy 1,000 years ago, about the year 1040. So, but that's a rabbinic ordinance. Nothing, quote unquote, happens if he transgresses that rabbinic ordinance. So if a man is a victim of get refusal, if he chooses to do so, he may not. He can start up a new relationship with another woman. As long as she's single, then he's not transgressing anything. If he chooses to marry her with a chuppah, you know, with a Jewish marriage, the marriage is valid. Because according to Torah law, he's allowed to have two wives. So he has two wives. And the same thing goes for a get refuser. If he's refusing to give a get, he can establish another family unit. And if he has children with that second woman, whether he is just living with her and she's single, or he married her according to Jewish law, the children that they bring into the world are great. I love children. They're great. There's no stigma. Not even the word illegitimate applies to them in Jewish law or Jewish thought. That's a Christian concept. There is no stigma whatsoever attached to those children. Nothing. Nothing. They're regular kids. However, if a woman is a victim of get refusal, she can't even go out for a cup of coffee with another man, let alone strike up an intimate relationship. And certainly not marry him, because a marriage would be a hoax, totally invalid, because a woman cannot have two husbands. And if she were to have intimate relations with another man while she was still a victim of get refusal and married to the first husband, to the first guy, then she would be committing adultery, one of the three biggest transgressions in Jewish law. And so would the other man. Together, they're committing adultery. And any children born of that union would be Mamzerim. There would be Mamzerim prohibited from marrying within the general Jewish community. Terrible, terrible tragedy. Man-made. Meaning, because of the get refusal, or because of the actions of the people. Add to that a difference between being victims of get refusal between men and women. Add to that that the woman has a biological clock ticking. And the woman wants to have children. She wants to have children, and when he is refusing to give her a get, every minute that passes by, I am not exaggerating, is one of existential angst. The deepest angst you can't imagine. Every minute. Because there's a clock ticking. And there's a time factor here. And the man wields enormous power. It's godlike power over her, saying you can have a child or you can't have a child. You can have a relationship or you can't have a relationship with somebody else. It's unnatural. In other words, he's taking her out of the natural state of affairs. Both men and women want relationships. And women in particular want children, and they're added to that the biological clock is ticking. Okay, so now we can understand that this is a very, very deep problem. And we would not want any person in this room, ever to fall into the trap of being a victim of get refusal. The problem is that when you get married, no one dreams of even getting divorced, let alone becoming a victim of get refusal. We don't get married in order to get divorced. I mean, duh, right? We all get married with the best of intentions, and we want to build a long-lasting relationship and a secure, sound Jewish family unit that's the building block of a healthy Jewish society and a healthy general society, and we don't think about getting divorced. Sometimes, people of your generation are wise enough to think about monetary prenuptial agreements. In other words, if you've worked in your life and you do have some assets, and your intended spouse also has other assets, then you're mature enough to write up a financial prenuptial agreement saying that these assets will be, let's say, for common use as long as we're married, but if, God forbid, the marriage ends, then each asset reverts back to its original owner. Something like that. They don't become marital property. That's more common today. What I'm bringing in front of you today is a prenuptial agreement that doesn't come to address that problem. It does also have it inside it, but that's not the point. I am bringing before you a prenuptial agreement for the prevention of get refusal. And it's based on a financial agreement. But a financial agreement that's never meant to be implemented, because what's really meant to be implemented is that a get should be given. This prenuptial agreement, I'm going to give you two sets of papers, all right? Because I recognize that not all of you are going to stay in Israel. Some of you are going to go back to your countries of origin. Some of you are going to go back to your countries of origin and then come back to Israel, which I sincerely advise, okay? And wherever you're going to get married, and all of you should meet your basharit and get married very quickly. Right? Amen. Right. Right. That I really mean that. Right. I'm going to show you two different prenuptial agreements. One is the agreement for mutual respect. In Hebrew, Hiskem L'Kavod Hadadi. It is drawn up for Israel, for use in Israel. The authors of this agreement were what I consider regular people. Two guys who were rabbis that turned into friends of mine and myself. We turned into friends. I didn't know them before. And it's a really cool story how we got together. Doesn't matter. Rabbi Eliashiv Knoll, the rabbi of Kibbutz Kfar Etzion, Rabbi Dr. David Ben Zazon, at the time he was the Rav of Kibbutz Ein Tzurim, now he lives in Lod and is the head of a mechina before the army, preparatory program for the army, and myself, Rachel Levmore, at the time as a Tohenet Rabbanit, a rabbinical court advocate, and still a rabbinical court advocate with doctor added to it. Okay, so we drew up a prenuptial agreement which was actually based on the prenuptial agreement that's been running for more than two decades in the United States. That prenuptial agreement is known by a few different names. It's known as the RCA agreement. The RCA is the Rabbinical Council of America. It is the largest organization of Orthodox rabbis in the world. It has over 1,000 members. It's modern Orthodox, based in New York. Rabbis all over the place. And in the 1980s, Rabbi Mordechai Willig drew up a prenuptial agreement to answer this need of protecting women from becoming victims of get refusal. And he brought it to Israel. And he got the agreement of really big names, of Rav Avadi Yosef, and Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg, and Rav Chaim Tzimbalist, and America Rav Gedalia Schwartz. Very big rabbis signed their agreement that this is kosher and this will work. And they have, the RCA has come out several times with resolutions that every RCA rabbi officiating at a wedding must see to it that a prenuptial agreement is signed, that this RCA prenuptial agreement is signed. On this page, you will see, tell me if you need more. Yeah, anybody else need more? Okay. On this page, you will see, first look at the page with the logo on top. The Rabbinical Council of America. The Rabbinical Council of America, let's just read the first one. Resolved that since there is a significant aguna problem in America and throughout the Jewish world, the Rabbinical Council of America declares that no rabbi should officiate at a wedding where a proper prenuptial agreement on get has not been executed. That the rabbi should not arrange a Jewish marriage if there has not been a prenuptial agreement. What are they saying? They're saying that everybody in this room has to sign a prenuptial agreement before they get married. Why? Because we don't know who it's going to happen to. We don't know. You're all good people. And we think all Jews are good people. But it's not that. Sometimes get refusal comes when the man or the woman is really not a good guy, right? Not a good guy, sometimes. But the legal and the Jewish law situation is such that without a prenuptial agreement, good people can become bad people. It's a psychological state, because they can argue, whoa, she hurt me, she did this, she's breaking up the family unit, she owes me $100,000, I'm not giving a get until I get what's coming to me. And you think that you're right, but you're so embroiled in the fight that, I mean, why do we need family court to solve divorce disputes? That's the problem. I'm not sure. How many of you have seen articles in American newspapers about high-profile aguna cases? Okay, at least half. The recent high-profile aguna cases, meaning in the past 5 years, there was a guy that worked in Congress. He worked in Congress. You're a lawyer, brilliant lawyer. He's a law-abiding citizen. He's a good guy. He'd never break any law. He worked on the Ways and Means Committee. That's the most powerful congressional committee in the country. All right? In the United States of America. And he was a horrible case of a get refuser. Horrible case. Is he a good guy? Yeah. But look, he... a get refuser. Another more recent example was the great-grandson of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Right? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was the leading halachic authority not only in the United States, but in the world during his time. And his own great-grandson, who was studying in the yeshiva of his grandson, right? It's all in the family there, was refusing to give a get. And for what? Money. He claimed, oh, she put me through this, that, the other thing, legal fees, whatever, $350,000. And he thought it was legitimate. Everybody else knew that it wasn't legitimate, but he didn't see it, that it wasn't legitimate. Right? So the point is that you don't get that far. I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that you don't get that far in a dispute when I explain the Israeli agreement. But I just want to show you the American agreement, that if you get married in America, just go to the Beth Din of America, or just write prenuptial agreement, or you go to the site called theprenup.org. All right? Or you can write to me, whatever. It's here. You can see. Turn it over. Turn it over. And you see the prenup.org, the Beth Din of America Prenuptial Agreement. Here I have quoted the heart of the agreement. What's the heart of an agreement? There's actually 2 points. Number one, you see where it says Roman numeral 7? The parties agree to appear in person before the Beth Din of America at the demand of the other party and to cooperate with the adjudication of the Beth Din of America in every way and manner. Let me explain something to you. Rabbinical courts outside of the state of Israel have no power. They're impotent. They cannot force you to appear before them. Even if you got married in a Jewish marriage, and but you decided you never want to see a rabbi again, you don't have to see a rabbi again. What's going to make you appear in front of a rabbinical court to arrange for a Jewish divorce? You can be forced to appear before a civil court, in civil family court, right? The judge has the power to haul you into court, to summons you, and to haul you into court, or to rule in your absence, and he creates the reality, that civil judge. He'll change your personal status, whether you're there or not. However, rabbinical courts have no power over their so-called constituents, right? Their congregation. They have no power. At best, if a rabbinical court has decided, Jack must give a get to his wife, and Jack's not even coming in to their offices. He's not even appearing before them. The most they can do is call Jack's mother and say, tell your son to listen to the rabbi. Right? That's the power of persuasion. That's what they have. So there's a problem also amongst Orthodox, very Orthodox, even ultra-Orthodox Jews in the diaspora, that yes, on their conscience, they do have to go to a rabbinical court. However, the husband and the wife can have a major dispute which rabbinical court to go to. And it will continue for years. Which rabbinical court is going to handle our divorce? She wants to go to this one, he wants to go to that one, and neither will go to the other. It will continue for years. So, the Beth Din of America's prenuptial agreement, first and foremost, in its framework, is a legally binding arbitration agreement. Every country has laws how you set up an arbitration agreement. And any two people can agree and say, if a dispute arises, two carpenters who set up partners who set up a carpentry shop. If they have a dispute between them, they can go to court and settle the dispute. Or when they set up the carpentry shop, they can sign a binding arbitration agreement that if there's a dispute between them, they're going to go to X. They're going to go to the milkman. It doesn't matter who. They write down the name of the person or the body who's going to be their arbiter, and that is a legally binding agreement to be upheld by courts, by civil courts. Here, too, the Beth Din of America is appointed to be the legal arbiter of any marital dispute they have. So then they can't fight over which rabbinical court they're going to go to. That's the first point. That's the legal framework. What's the heart of it? If you look at what's in italics, I hear by now the husband is writing. The husband-to-be. I hereby now obligate myself to support my wife-to-be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease, for whatever reasons, at the rate of $150 per day. Let's stop here. When a man marries a woman, according to Jewish law, he is obligated to support her. He's obligated to support her. What this says is that when a man marries a woman, he's going to support her even if she leaves him, until their Jewish marriage is terminated, meaning until there's a get. And to make it have teeth, they write down how much is this support. And they say $150 a day, $200 a day, $250 a day, doesn't matter. It says $150 a day, you can change it, from the date that their marriage together, their residence together shall cease. And this is a financial incentive, actually a negative financial incentive, that will spur the man into giving the get. Understood? Yeah.
But in the case of a congressman who might have a lot of money, it might be that $150 a day, although it's a significant amount to maybe people in this room, is not a significant amount to somebody in the 1%.
You're right. However, money talks. People don't like to lose money. And it's been shown that no matter what the standard of living the husband has, this agreement, I said, has been in effect, it's been used for over 20 years, has been proven to be 100% effective. 100% effective. People don't want to lose money. And moreover, what happens is that the whole psychological situation changes. Let's put the agreement aside. What happens in a regular case of divorce between a man and a woman? If it's unilateral, if one of them doesn't realize that a divorce is necessary here, the spouse comes and says, I want a divorce. Unavoidably, he gets a shock. He feels pain. He's crying, literally. Can't avoid it. He's crying. After a while, the crying turns to anger. For every unilateral divorce, the crying turns to anger. And in Jewish couples, the anger turns to rage. The rage turns to retribution and vindictiveness. And the vindictiveness turns into self-destruction. Why? Because he understands that he has got a powerful tool in his hand that he can ruin the woman's life. He can ruin her life, or the other way around, to a certain degree. He can ruin the woman's life. In Israel, it's really mutual, the problem. And what this agreement has done is that it stops that process at the beginning. The psychological cycle is halted at the point of the pain and maybe the anger. Because what does he do? And I've heard this. This actually happens in the United States with the RCA agreement. It has happened. She sends a letter. The woman sends a letter to her husband and says, I want to implement the binding arbitration prenuptial agreement that we signed at the beginning of our marriage, before we got married. What's the next thing he does? The next day, the next morning, he runs to his lawyer. And he shows him the letter of notification. He shows him the agreement. And the lawyer says, if it's in Israel, he says, Habibi. He says, in your interest, I'm telling you, you came to me to look out for your interests. I'm telling you that we have to negotiate a divorce agreement, a divorce settlement, right away, and you should give your wife a get right away, or else she's going to milk you for money for the rest of your life. As long as you don't give her a get, you're going to turn into an ATM machine. That's what they say in Israel, kaspomat. You're going to turn into an ATM machine. This woman left you. What do you want to give her money for? And it's a principle. It doesn't matter if it's only $150, right? So he says, what? She's going to milk me for money? I'm going to give her a get and show her that she's not going to get any money out of me for support. All right, do you understand? The psychology was flipped, yeah.
You said it's also the woman has to accept the get, right?
Right.
So if let's say the woman escapes with another man, and so they don't cohabitate, and she doesn't want to accept the get, so the husband has to pay her like for her entire life if she doesn't want to.
No, because she wouldn't be approaching in the United States. She would not be approaching the Beth Din and asking for a get. In other words, she approaches the Beth Din and shows them the prenuptial agreement only when she's asking for a get. If the Beth Din has to rule, the Beth Din has to rule, the rabbinical court has to rule, and say, Are you willing to give a get? Are you willing to give a get? Monday morning, 9 o'clock, both of you be here and arrange the get. And if she ran away, then it's not in good faith. And they will not rule that he has to pay the $150. Okay. Now, your question is a little bit stronger if you apply it to the Israeli agreement, which I'm going to give out now. But I want to point out that according to civil law, outside of the state of Israel, if there's a civil divorce and there's no get, there's nothing holding back civilly both spouses from remarrying. So the man can remarry both civilly and according to Jewish law, transgressing Rabbeinu Gershon's ordinance that he may not. But there's no practical consequence for it. He can remarry and start a new life. The woman can't. So the problem, basically, in outside of the state of Israel, is that women are victims of get refusal more often than men. If a man is a victim of get refusal, there is another way out. He can go to the rabbinic court, and the rabbinic court can issue a permit that's signed by 100 rabbis that says, yes, you can remarry, in order to overcome the rabbinical ordinance of Rabbeinu Gershom that he didn't let you remarry. We can allow you to remarry. The woman has no such way out. So even if a man were in that position, he could remarry in accordance to the rulings of the rabbinical court. However, if the situation is more difficult inside the state of Israel. Because in the state of Israel, as I said, we have no civil marriage. We have no civil divorce. So they cannot remarry as long as there isn't a get between them. No matter who is a get refuser and who is the victim of get refusal, they cannot legally, civilly remarry and establish. The man can go ahead and live with another woman, but he legally, he's committing bigamy if he marries her in a private Orthodox ceremony. And as a result, divorce in the state of Israel can only be reached by agreement of both the husband and the wife. Both spouses, I started off my talk now by saying that you need both spouses to agree to go into the union. Both spouses in the state of Israel have to agree to leave the union, for both civil and religious purposes. Outside of the state of Israel, it's only for religious purposes, not for civil purposes. Okay, so we have in Israel the agreement for mutual respect, Hasken L'Kavod Hadadi. It's translated into five languages: Hebrew, English, French, Spanish, and Russian. Everybody get a copy? What I just distributed to you is an instruction sheet on top, and the next two pages are selections of the agreement for mutual respect. And all right, there's no board here. I'm going to make believe I'm writing on a board, all right? I want to explain to you how this agreement works. This agreement, where can it be found? It can be found here at the bottom of the page. It says IYIM, International Young Israel Movement, .org.il, right? It can be found there. And I am asking you to please join the Facebook group. You know what? I'm going to tell you right now why you should join the Facebook group, even before I explain what this agreement is about, all right? In detail. Whoever's single here, one day a friend is going to say, I've got a person for you. I said person because it's either guy or girl, right? I've got a person for you. The name is such and such. What's the first thing you do? Who said it? Facebook, what people? That's good. Facebook is a new yikos. Show me who your friends are. I'll know who you are. Oh, that was really good. Thank you. Okay. You go to Facebook. All right. Let's say the guy goes to Facebook, checks out the girl on Facebook, sees her picture, and he sees also what kind of music she likes, and she sees that he sees that she's was a member of the group Save Jonathan Pollard. She's a member of the group Save the Whales. She's a member of the group Vegetarians Forever, and she's a member of the group The Agreement for Mutual Respect for the Prevention of Get Refusal. Okay. Now, either he goes into Save the Whales, or he doesn't go into Save the Whales. Either he goes into the Agreement for Mutual Respect, or he doesn't go into the Agreement for Mutual Respect. But the fact is that it was right there on a Facebook page. All right? Maybe he goes in, maybe he doesn't. They start to date. They start to get serious. Either he remembers that he saw this weird thing on her Facebook page in the beginning, and they talk about it, about the Agreement for Mutual Respect, and she says, well, I heard this lady come give a lecture in Pardes, and she forced us to da-da-da, right? Whatever. And then they start talking about the issues, or it never comes up. And then they decide to get engaged. And then when they get engaged, the young woman says to the young man, we have to sign a prenuptial agreement for the prevention of get refusal. It's a principle for me. And he could say, if she wasn't a member of that Facebook group, he would say to her, what? You don't trust me? What kind of way is that to start a relationship? He could say that, right? Or he could say, what? You want to talk about divorce now? We're just getting married. He could say that. However, if she was a member of the Facebook group before he even met her, before she or he knew that the other one existed, he knows it's not personal. It's a matter of principle that she was always a vegetarian and she was always for Jonathan Pollard being released and she was always for signing a prenuptial agreement and she was going to do it with any guy that she met and married. And it's much easier to do it that way. That's the way you do it. So please, men and women, please join the Facebook group and make sure that you do what you should be doing because you learned today. Your friends didn't learn. And you make sure that all your friends know about it and that they understand that they too have to sign a prenuptial agreement. Because there is a given divorce rate. In the United States, it's 50%. In Israel, it's about 30%. We can't change that. People divorce for reasons that people divorce. But what we can change, and so 30% around of your friends are going to get divorced. What you can do is protect them from themselves. Keep good people, even while they divorce. Let them stay good. Let them not hurt each other or hurt themselves. Have them sign the prenuptial agreement. Okay, so now let's go to the Israeli one. The Israeli is really what its name says, the agreement for mutual respect. It sees to it that a get is given out of respect in a dignified manner. And it has the same basic monetary mechanism in both directions. Both men are protected here and women are protected here. There's the same monetary mechanism of spousal support, drawn up a little bit differently with different language. And I want you to understand that the language differs also between the language, not the result. The language used to describe the woman's obligation and the man's obligation is slightly different because the Jewish law has them on different planes. And in order to equalize the planes, we had to use different Jewish law language, Jewish legal language. But the result is exactly the same. And I'm going to explain to you what the result is. Please turn to the last page. Clause F. The result is a mirror image, the man and the woman. Okay, I can't repeat that enough. Obligations of the woman. The woman hereby now obligates herself to make monthly maintenance payments, that's support payments, right, to the man from the expiration of the period and the extended period, as long as they are married in accordance with Orthodox Jewish law. I'll explain. In the greater of the following two sums, A, $1,500, or B, 50% of her average income, her average monthly income. The greater of the sums. That handles the question that you had here about $150 a day is not enough. So here, it goes up to half of her income, or his income, which is reasonable. Because when a couple gets married, most couples share everything. So half of your income is reasonable. But believe me, even Bill Gates would not want to give away half of his income to a wife that left him. Right? So the money works. What does this mean? How does the mechanism here in the Agreement for Mutual Respect work? It's got a timeline. So let's picture, I'm drawing a timeline. We've got day zero over here, day zero. On day zero, one of the spouses sends a notification to the other spouse, okay, that I want to implement the agreement, meaning I want to get a divorce, and I want to do it quietly and quickly, with respect. I want to talk about it. The agreement, I'll just tell you now, the result of this agreement is that it brings about communication between two spouses who aren't talking to each other. That's the source of all the problems in divorce cases, that the two spouses aren't talking to each other. This agreement forces both of them to talk to each other, both of them. You'll see how in a minute. Let's say the man sends a notification that he wants to implement this agreement. Day zero. A clock starts ticking, 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 until day 180. What happens on day 180? That's 6 months later. On day 180, there's a test. They come to the rabbinic court, and the rabbinic court has made an appointment, and they see who shows up for the get. Who's going through with the arrangement of the get? One shows up, one doesn't. In that case, the one who doesn't show up is now obligated to pay the $1,500, minimum $1,500, right? Or half of his monthly income. The one who showed up for the get and wants to go through with the get without any conditions attached. No conditions. Nothing about the children, their custody, their education, their support, the division of the assets. Pure get. Just the get. One shows up, one doesn't. The one who doesn't show up or doesn't give the get, go through with the procedure, he's the one that owes spousal maintenance, monthly maintenance. All right? So, what did I just describe? I just described a six-month period building up to a change in reality. You have 6 months to understand that you're going to lose a lot of money. That understanding dawns on the person when he's reminded that he signed this, dawns on him very quickly. And that forces him to enter into divorce negotiations in good faith, because he also wants to give the get before 6 months are up, because he doesn't want to be $1,500 a month out of pocket. Both of them want to talk about a get. And they do. And they reach a get. In a matter of weeks, without going to court, there are no disputes. They settle the children. They settle the child support. They settle the division of assets. Because they're forced to talk to each other, and both of them want to get as soon as possible. Now, there's another process that's going on.
What starts that process?
One of them sends a notification. That's the trigger to the process. Implement the agreement. That's all. No, to each other. By registered mail. Okay? Now, there's another process that goes on that can go on during that six-month period. Please look at, page 2. Rehabilitation of the marriage, Clause C. The notice recipient The one who gets the notice, who thinks that we shouldn't be divorcing, we have a good thing going here, all right? The person getting the notice may request to rehabilitate the marriage with the help of a professional counselor accepted by both parties, meaning a therapist. And if they can't agree on the identity of the therapist, then there's a certain union of therapists that will appoint a therapist for them. What happens here is that if the person that says, I don't want to give a get, I want us to live happily married, this is a passing crisis, maybe we can rekindle the love that was between us, we just need to learn new tools how to communicate, right? Let's say he honestly says that. If so, then he can see to it that a therapist is appointed, a professional therapist, not a rabbi. A professional therapist is appointed, and then the person who sent the notice, the one who wants to get, has to go within the same 180 days. You don't lose any time. It's only if appointments were set up within the 180 days, up to 3 times. If the person, let's say the guy sent the notice, refuses to go to the appointments, he won't be able to implement the obligation. He won't be able to get the money. So, if one of them wants marital therapy, they both have to go only during the 180 days. During the 180 days. That causes them to talk to each other through the therapist. If it's a lost cause, then the therapist didn't help. So they will reach an agreement to a get. If the therapist sees that there's something to work with here, maybe I can save this marriage, he'll save the marriage. To the point that the agreement gives the therapist the power, if he thinks, I only met with them 3 times, but I think I can get them to reach an agreement together, an agreement either to live together or to return to each other, or an agreement to divorce, if I only had a little bit more time with them. So the therapist, one time, and one time only, can extend that period before the test by 3 months to 270 days, meaning till 9 months. And again, they have to attend up to 3 sessions within those 3 months. But if they haven't reached any agreement with the therapist by the end of 9 months, then that test day arrives and nobody can change it. Not a judge, not a rabbinical judge, not even the notice recipient. The person who sends the notice can change it. He or she has the power to extend and give more time if necessary. But if there's a test and one doesn't show up for the get, he will start paying $1,500 minimum. And that's what prevents him from getting into that mess in the first place. That specter of $1,500 or half of my income up there in the sky, 6 months down the line, that specter that I'm going to be losing that money, gives him a wake-up call. Money talks. And he instead flips and says, okay, let's negotiate a divorce settlement. And they negotiate a divorce settlement. It has been proven to work every time. Okay. I'm 5 minutes over. Write down my email address. If you ever have any questions, please email me. R. Levmore. R-L-E-V as in Victor, M as in Max, O-R-E @gmail.com. Please join the Facebook group. It'll be a reminder to yourselves also. Okay.